Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Sammy Yenigan. You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week on Culturetopia, Justin Timberlake's new movie is about a man who uses time as cash. With the celebrity's adventures in comedy, music, and acting, it's hard to believe Timberlake has any time to spare. Then, Rita Moreno and John Leguizamo talk about the hurdles they've faced in a town that sometimes just sees brown, and how it helps to have a signature sense of humor. And finally, the legendary singer Tony Bennett talks about his legacy, longevity, and his latest record, Duets 2, which pairs him with artists from Lady Gaga to Aretha Franklin. But first,
in cities big and small this weekend, people will gather, as they do every Halloween weekend, for an annual ritual. Saturday night, from Johnson City, Tennessee, to Midland, Michigan, zombies will emerge to reenact the Thriller Dance. Nearly 30 years after its debut, Michael Jackson's Thriller is still hugely popular. In addition to the annual Halloween gatherings, people are still making remixes of the song. And a quick search of YouTube reveals dozens of tribute videos. To talk about Thriller's remarkable staying power, we track down the man who produced and directed Michael Jackson's seminal video, John Landis. He joins us now from London. John Landis, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Take me back to when you actually filmed this.
The album, Thriller, was already out for over a year and was the number one selling album of all time already. They had made two videos, Billie Jean and Beat It. Michael was really the first black artist played on MTV, a huge star. And Thriller, the album, was now like number seven or six when Michael contacted me. He had seen An American Werewolf in London, a movie I made that had remarkable makeup effects by Rick Baker. Michael contacted me, and he just wanted to turn into a monster. And I thought about it, and I thought, no, I don't want to do a rock video. They're just commercials for records. And but then I thought, you know what, Mike? How about a theatrical short? And he said, sure.
When you were filming this, was it hard to cast dancers who could dance beautifully but do so as zombies and wear all that makeup, which had to be, you know, heavy and take a lot of time to put on also?
Well, we actually got wonderful dancers because dancers were very anxious to dance with Michael. Michael was an extraordinary dancer. And, I mean, working with Michael Jackson at that time was really nuts. I mean, Fred Astaire came by, Gene Kelly came by, Jackie Kennedy came by. It was Marlon Brando came by. I mean, it was insane. And, they all felt, they really kind of felt privileged to be working with him. And at that time, Michael was 20 years old, and he was wonderful and full of beans. And he was great. He did everything I asked. I remember when I wrote it, I said, Mike, you know, this line, I'm not like other guys, is going to get a laugh. And he said, why? And I said, well, because, Mike, you're not like other guys, and people will laugh. He said, that's okay. I mean, he really was terrific to work with.
When you were filming this, was there any sort of tension in trying to walk a fine line to make a video that would be spooky, but not too spooky, because you were also trying to reach out to young people? I had a chance to talk to Quincy Jones about the filming of this video at one point, and he said that there was a concern about kids who would see this, or young, you know, Michael Jackson always had a
You know, Quincy was there for about... Quincy was there for about 2 hours one night.
Ah, okay.
So he may have been concerned.
He touched down lightly.
I don't know. But, you know, I have to tell you that the music in the video is quite different than the record. That's a story I'll tell now because the statute of limitations is up. But the engineer Bruce Swydeen and the brilliant Quincy Jones, they wouldn't let me have the original tracks. And I tried to explain, I'm going to do a movie mix, which is very different than Needle Drop, which is what videos were and still are. And in order to do that, I needed the original tracks. So I told Michael, and he said, oh, we'll get them. So George Folsey and I and Michael went in Michael's car. He had a big Rolls Royce. We went to the recording studio in Studio City about 3 o'clock in the morning, walked through the lobby, and Mike waved to the night watchman with a big suitcase. We went in the back. We took the reels off the racks, went out, drove across town to Tadeo in Hollywood, duped all the tracks, and then returned them. The whole thing took an hour.
You're kidding.
And if you watch the video, people never noticed the song is 11 minutes long in the video. And it's the same original tracks, totally recut and remixed. In fact, Vincent Price re-recorded the narration for me because I couldn't use the record narration because it was mixed with a synth track. And Mr. Price very graciously came in and redid it.
John Landis directed and produced Michael Jackson's Thriller video, as well as many other classic Hollywood films, including National Lampoon's Animal House and The Blues Brothers. His new book is called Monsters in the Movies. John Landis, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We continue our series, Two Languages, Many Voices, today with the story of two generations of Latino actors in Hollywood. Rita Moreno began her career in the 1940s. Half a century later, John Leguizamo found that not much had changed for Hispanics in the movie industry, as NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
Rita Moreno is the only Latino actor to win an Emmy, a Tony, and an Oscar. At nearly 80 years old, she's reprising some of her most memorable characters on stage at the Berkeley Repertory Theater. In the 1961 movie West Side Story, Moreno portrayed feisty Anita, the sister of a gang member, and like Moreno, Puerto Rican.
Puerto Rico.
When I got the part, I thought, dear God, because she says, island of tropic diseases. And I thought, I can't say that. I can't say that about my beautiful little island. Island of tropic diseases? Woo!
Moreno says there were other issues with West Side Story. The director and choreographer wanted a big contrast between the warring gangs, the Sharks and the Jets.
So the white kids, a lot of them had to have their hair bleached. They wore extra pale makeup. And we, on the other hand, had to wear one color makeup, very, very dark. Almost the color of mud, and it felt like it. So we all had to have accents. And I remember asking the makeup man one day in real annoyance, why can't the makeup match our different skin tones? Because Hispanics are many different, some of us are very fair.
Still, Moreno says she's grateful for the role that earned her a Best Supporting Actress Oscar. During the filming of West Side Story, she created her own Puerto Rican character with an amusing accent, Gugi Gomez.
One day she just sort of hiccuped her. I had a dream about you, baby. And from then on, I just began to do her because she was so funny. She's still funny to me.
I had a dream.
A lot of people asked me at the time, were Latinos offended? I never got one response. They laughed their heads off because they know that character. The big hair, big attitude. She's a huge exaggeration.
She played Gugi Gomez in The Ritz and earned a Tony Award. But between the awards, she only got to play what she called the Conchita Lolita Latina roles, or the generic ethnic.
I played a Siamese girl from Thailand. I played an Arabian girl. I did a lot of American Indians. I never, ever was able to do a part without assuming some kind of accent.
Moreno says it was frustrating and demoralizing to be typecast, but by the 1970s, she was finally able to do something different on television.
Hey, you guys!
On the children's show The Electric Company, she co-starred with Bill Cosby and Morgan Freeman. Today, Moreno plays a Jewish mother on the TV show Happily Divorced, and she enjoys watching younger comedic actors like Sofia Vergara on Modern Family.
Yeah, she's hilarious.
Moreno says Latinos today are rarely given the kind of meaty roles that land them big awards, but that it's a bit easier for them now than when she started out in Hollywood.
It's not great, but it's a whole lot better. As Ricardo Montalban said, the door is ajar.
Yeah. You got to kick your foot in there and then kick the other foot and then throw somebody in there quick. Yeah, that's where you got to do it.
Backstage at the Ricardo Montalban Theater in Hollywood, John Leguizamo is getting ready for his latest one-man show about his life as a Latino actor.
It's much better than it's ever been, but, I mean, we're 15% of the population. Why aren't we even close to that in representation?
Like Rita Moreno, who was born Rosita Dolores Alveiro, John Leguizamo was pressured by casting agents and managers to change his name.
And I didn't. I stuck with my name, and then I gave him the, I flipped him the bird, and I said, I'm going to write my Latin stories that y'all don't tell, that I can't see anywhere.
In a series of one-man shows he wrote himself, Leguizamo began portraying characters from his New York neighborhood and his life. He got the attention of Hollywood.
Fuacata, placata, chancleta, chuleta, que nada me joda, manteca y tocineta, chango!
In Leguizamo's latest show, Ghetto Clown, the 47-year-old describes his rise from a wisecracking Puerto Rican Colombian breakdancer to his on-screen roles, beginning with a small part on TV's Miami Vice.
The Latin exploitational TV series of the 80s.
And I become Calderon Jr., cocaine Colombian mafia prince. And as you can see, I'm the palest Latin brother of the bunch. But I blame my grandfather, because when he found out I was doing television, he was like, mijito, nenito, only white Latinos make it to Telemundo, mijito.
And just like Rita Moreno before him, Leguizamo found himself auditioning for the most stereotypical TV and film roles.
It'd be me and all the same dudes. It'd be Benicio del Toro, Benjamin Bratt, Isai Morales. And you go out there, and Jimmy Smits, and it'd be all gang leaders, drug dealers, janitors, murderers, and you're like, all these roles, really? Really? Don't we just contribute more? I mean, I went to college, man. I'm an educated human being, and I know lots of hyper-educated Latin people.
So Leguizamo took aim at the stereotypes. His short-lived TV show House of Buggin' often satirized Hollywood depictions of Latinos.
Who would win in a fight? The Crips and Bloods versus the Sharks of West Side Story.
When he did get cast in movies, the former class clown ad-libbed to get attention. He ended up fighting, literally fighting, with big stars Al Pacino, Sean Penn, Steven Seagal, and Patrick Swayze. Leguizamo says he got better opportunities, but still, he hit what he calls the plexiglass ceiling of Hollywood, or Hollywoodn't.
The blocks were constant, and they were, and I had to constantly overlook them, ignore them. You know, this great producer was like, John, you're so talented. Too bad you're Puerto Rican, because you'd be so much further along.
Eventually, Leguizamo had enough clout to create his own Latino characters, like the drag queen Chichi Rodriguez in the movie Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar.
I'm the Latino Marilyn Monroe. I got more legs than a bucket of chicken.
Other roles came his way, too. A Navy SEAL, a cartoon sloth, even a famous French painter in the musical Moulin Rouge.
How do you do? My name is Henri-Marie Raymond Toulouse-Lautrec Monge.
Like Rita Moreno, a generation before, John Leguizamo made it into Hollywood his way, and he's learned the best roles are the ones you create yourself. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
When you think of American classics, you might think of baseball, Abe Lincoln, apple pie, and Anthony Dominic Benedetto. Tony Bennett.
I know I'd go from rags to riches. Just in time, I found you just in time. I left my heart in San Francisco.
Tony Bennett's released more than 70 albums in a career that spans 60 years. His latest, Duets 2, in which he collaborates with Willie Nelson, Aretha Franklin, Mariah Carey, John Mayer, Amy Winehouse, Natalie Cole, Lady Gaga, and more outstanding musicians. Tony Bennett joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Got to get to that Lady Gaga collaboration. So whose idea was this?
It was my son's idea to do The Lady is a Tramp.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8.
I'm starving.
She loves the theater, but she never comes late.
I never bother with people that I hate. That's why this chick is a tramp.
She does it like crap games with barons and earls.
I won't go to Harlem in diamonds and pearls. And I definitely won't dish our dirt with the rest of those girls.
Thank you. That's why the lady is a tramp.
Now, she's got, obviously, a very distinctive pop voice, but she's a great jazz singer, isn't she?
She sings beautiful. It was a wonderful experience. What I liked about it, at the end of the recording, she went around to everybody that had anything to do with setting it up, the microphones or whatever, and she thanked them all for being so nice to her. She was a very professional attitude about things.
That's why the lady is a tramp. Go!
How do you figure out on an album like this what songs to pick and what singers to approach?
Well, funny enough, this is a very unusual album that I've made in all the years I've been recording. I really involved my personal family making the album. Mm-hmm. My son did all of the engineering of the recordings. And then my other son has been managing me for many, many years, and he chose all of the contemporary artists. I honestly didn't know most of them.
The CD gets a lot of attention, well, because it's yours, but also one of the last recordings of Amy Winehouse.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh. For you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul.
I spend my days ever hungering and wondering why.
Johnny Green's great body and soul, Tony Bennett, and the late Amy Winehouse. You're sitting here and you're shaking your head as if to say, what a loss.
Mm-hmm. By the way, thank you for mentioning Johnny Green, who I considered one of the most intelligent men I've ever met, and a beautiful composer and a magnificent human being. But Amy, what a tragedy. She was as great as Ella or Billie Holiday. She had the whole gift. What a tragedy it is that she could have had the most beautiful life just singing songs like that.
Sounds like you were very touched by meeting her.
I was, yeah, because my master was Sinatra.
Yeah.
When Elvis Presley came along, the whole business world changed, you know, into big stadiums, and the art of intimacy was gone. Yeah. So then there was the Beatles and Elvis Presley and the Rolling Stones and so on. And I kept listening to and saying, let me hear a singer. I want to hear a Nat Cole. I want to hear a Sinatra. You know, I want to hear a Joe Stafford or Ella Fitzgerald. And she was the first one that came along of all the young ladies that actually had the gift. She was a great singer.
Are you pretending and looks like the ending, unless I could one more chance for
birthday. My life a wreck you're making.
You know I'm yours, but just the taking.
I can't be sure.
Who else would you like to do a duet with?
Louis Armstrong.
Well, someday. I hope not too
no
soon.
No trick. He was too good.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
What a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is our last dance together. Tonight soon will be long ago. And in our moment of parting, this is all I want you to know.
Tony Bennett. His latest album, Duets 2, is out now, and you can see Tony Bennett's performance by going to our website, nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition, directed by Claudine DeBade and produced by Gemma Waters, Kimberly Adams, Hansi Lo Wang, Chris Benderev, Ned Wharton, Elaine Heinzman, J.J. Sutherland, and our interns, Colleen Shelby and Jewel Johnson. Didi Skanky and Jeff Bennett edited the program. Our world champion technical director is Burke Hun. Our librarians, Kim Molesky and Mary Glendinning. Our web producer is Melissa Goh. Our show was edited today by Deborah George and produced by Peter Breslow. Sarah Lucy Oliver is our supervising producer, and the senior supervising producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. I'm Scott Simon.
There will be other lips that I may kiss, but they won't thrill me like yours used to do. I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true?
Our music segment today, the new Sinatra. Well, Justin Timberlake may very well be his generation's Sinatra or Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. Don't be so quick to walk away. It's me. I wanna rock your body. Please stay. He sings, he dances, he acts, and in recent years, Justin Timberlake's made a name for himself in comedy bits on Saturday Night Live. In last year's film, The Social Network, he played Sean Parker, an early backer of Facebook, and Timberlake's portrayal earned him high praise from the critics. His new movie is a futuristic sci-fi thriller. It's called In Time. Timberlake plays Will Salas. He's a man who is trapped in a world where no one ages past 25 years old, and money can literally save your life. When he sat down with us recently, we asked him about his music, his life, and of course, his new film.
It's a future where time is the currency. You know, time is money, and we're able to give that money back and forth.
A man named Henry Hamilton gave me over a century. He said he didn't need it anymore. It was a gift. I'm not a thief. But hey, if you guys are looking for stolen time, maybe you should arrest everyone here.
And, you know, our lifespan is directly linked to a digital ticking clock that's on our left forearm, and when you run out of time, you die. It's about separating class by wealth.
Justin Timberlake, this is really the first time that you have played the leading character in the film. What was that like for you? Was it difficult for you?
It's funny, when you're making the movie, you're obviously not as conscious of it, and then you screen the whole thing after they finish it, and you become incredibly insecure because you're seeing your face the whole film. But I don't know. I think I wanted to play this character because I admired him. I admired his courage and his brass. So it was a lot of fun to play this character. I mean, look, you tack on getting to shoot guns and kick ass and kiss hot girls and flip cars, and it's like every boyhood fantasy.
Isn't that your real life, though?
Yeah. I shoot guns at people. I try to get in a fight once a day, and just randomly kiss as many women as possible. No, you know, I think it's every boyhood fantasy trapped into one film. So, I mean, I had a ball playing this character.
Justin, the breakthrough role for you was the one you played in the film Social Network as Sean Parker. How much did that film open a whole new world for you?
Yeah, that's sort of my running joke with all of my closest friends, is that I should have a business card that says, David Fincher put me in a movie. No, I obviously saw that character on the page as sort of this kind of sociopath in a way. And I felt like the biggest trick that I could possibly pull off in playing that character was sort of, for as long as possible, make the audience question who they should side with. And I feel like my favorite villains, in a way, tend to do that. And I didn't necessarily see him as a villain. I thought he had a very clear-cut point of view. And, you know, when you walk away from that film, it's you still have to say, you know, without the character of Sean Parker in that movie, that company never reaches $1 billion. I'm bringing sexy back.
Justin, I'm looking at a photograph that was taken of you for Vanity Fair. It ran over the summer, and you're in a hotel room. There's a beautiful woman behind you. Your tie is undone, and you're holding what looks like a glass of scotch, very sort of suave. And it just occurred to me that women like you, men like you, it seems like you don't have a problem being likable. And I'm wondering how much you think that has to do with the comedy that you've done.
I don't know. I feel like there's something to be said about feeling comfortable with what you have and don't have. And for instance, I don't think I'm particularly a great singer, but I feel like I write songs that complement my voice, you know, and I feel like it's unique. And I don't feel like I'm a particularly great actor, for instance, but I feel like I approach each thing that I do with some level of sensitivity. And I would say that comedy in general is the most disarming.
What about you, Cornelius Timberlake? What do you hope your great-great-grandson will be like?
I actually dream of a day when my great-great-grandson will bring sexy back.
Bring sexy back? What does that mean?
It'll be gone and he'll bring it back.
Laughter can be, it kind of breaks this wall down that I feel like people have because they might have some perception of who you might be. I guess I would definitely agree with you on that.
There's a price to pay for it. I mean, you can't walk around Los Angeles or New York or you can't really have a normal day, can you?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I feel like I have normal days just like everybody else where I do walk around New York. And let's be clear, no one walks around Los Angeles. We all drive. It's ridiculous. But, you know, for every sort of experience I have where you feel like you might be photographed in your free time or someone might recognize you, I can add them up to days as well that you don't have that experience. And I don't know, maybe it's just that those aren't as interesting to talk about. Take my order, cause your body like a carry out. Let me walk into your body till you hear me out. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out. Take my order, cause your body like a carry out.
Justin, I know that you've been focusing on your acting career, and you haven't had an album since 2006. But there is, as you may know, an online campaign. It's called Justin Timberlake Make Music Again. One of the YouTube clips has like 400,000 views. Do you know about this?
I actually took to my Twitter to post it.
So what do you think about that?
I thought it was very funny.
Yeah. But I mean, people do want this. And of course, you know, you make your own choices. But does it ever factor into how you think about things? I mean, do you ever think, well, maybe I should start thinking about that again?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, specifically when it comes to music, I don't think that I need any persuading to think about it. It's always kind of in the back of your mind, but I think it's part of who I am and always will be, I mean, in a very cellular way. When you grow up doing, you know, one thing, I think you get to this place where you want to try new things and, you know, I do think that we live in the type of world where people get comfortable with you in one way, and so seeing you in a different way it takes some time.
Hmm. Yeah. Justin, last year you did something for NPR that was more meaningful and valuable than 100 hours of me doing my show, which is you wore an NPR T-shirt, and it was photographed and published in a magazine. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, I told you, it wasn't because I thought it was hip. I actually am a really big fan.
Well, by all means, wear that shirt as much as you want.
Okay. I have to get a new one, you know. It's gotten some wear and tear. I actually wear it a lot, so.
All right, good. Just make sure you're photographed on those days.
I'm not sure how to do that, but you have my word. If I happen to see someone photographing me, I won't cover up the logo.
All right. That's actor and musician Justin Timberlake. His new movie, In Time, is in theaters now. Justin, thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Don't feel me, baby. It's just Justin.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Sammy Ennegan. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. In your colorful face.